The fuck is that? Okay, 3, 2, 1, roll. All right, we just get all that out there. Nobody ever gonna know a goddamn thing. Turn your mic on!
It'll be a little editing.
Goddamn, we've been down here for fucking 45 minutes trying to figure this shit out. It's what you get when you broadcast it from a basement. Welcome to No Bullshit News Hour.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome back, Bob.
Thank you much.
Sorry you wiped out on the motorcycle.
I did, but I'm okay. The bike's okay.
At least this year you're not in a coma.
True dad.
Listen, we got a show about the people, the power and the government and whose it is and what we get. I just want to tell you, I'm thinking, I'm no longer going to say fight the power. I'm not going to say fight the power because the people are the power.
Amen.
Do not fight yourselves. Follow the rules and the protocols and the laws we've all agreed upon. We discuss it, we vote, the majority rules, and we all abide by the safeguards to protect the rights of the minorities. That's called our Bill of Rights.
Amen.
Free speech, right?
That's what makes America
to
America.
To be free from unreasonable search and seizure. Your expectation of privacy. We're going to get to all that today. Karen is out. She had surgery. I hope she's all right.
We wish Karen the best. God, hi, really. Karen.
Before we get to it, just some business from people supporting this show. Brought to you by Luke Nowacki. Maybe you're a big-time city official who can travel with your entourage on the city's dime. Maybe you can hook up your girlfriend with government contracts, Mike. But if you're not among the elite who can make their pals' pockets fat off the taxpayers' back, your back, people, your money, then we're all going to have to provide our own retirement, and we're going to have to provide for theirs. And if you have any questions whether you're on the right track, call our good friend, financial specialist Luke Nowacki at 248-663-4748. Give him a call. Just see where you're at. It's no high pressure. Give him a call. Grow your assets from pension planning to college savings plan. Your politicians are depending on you. Luke Nowacki can help. 248-663-4748. Securities and investment advisory services offered through Royal Alliance Associates, Inc. Member FINRA, SIPC. Royal Alliance Associates, Inc., separately owned, and other entities or marketing names, products, or services referenced here are independent of Royal Alliance Associates, Inc.
Your politicians are counting on you. Come on, people. Give Luke a call.
Look out for each other and yourselves. Now, guess what now? Joe got his glasses. He's excited about his new glasses.
Nice.
He looks pretty good, and he can see clearly now. He really can. He said he can see his dashboard without leaning into it.
Oh, that's good.
Which is good.
For everybody.
Because he was hit and run a couple of weeks ago while he's changing his tire.
No.
He can't see shit, but now he can. And we're all very pleased by everybody's generosity. You are great and loyal listeners, donated money to pay for them. But dig, Yaldo said, it's on us. We'll take care of Joe's eye exam, lenses and frames. No charge. Thank you, doctor. So.
Thank you, Dr. Yaldo.
What I think we're going to do is donate the money to charity or maybe call Nowacki and start a retirement fund for Joe because everybody donated it for Joe because
for Joe.
They love Joe. So that's what we're going to do. Luke, expect the call. Let me remind you, Dr. Yaldo is Michigan's most prominent eye surgeon for the past 2 decades and remains the leader in LASIK procedures. It's safe, people. It's safe.
And you can see better.
You can see better. His multifocal implants enable people 45 plus to never need reading glasses again. Dr. Yaldo has done nearly 60,000 LASIK and implant procedures, changing the lives of all those patients who wanted 20/20 vision and had and wanted and did and are done with glasses, contacts, and reading shades forever. It does work.
Nice.
And, you know, like I said, look what Joe got.
He got
his eyes checked. He got some nice glasses. He can see.
He can see now.
This is an ophthalmologist. This is no meat factory. This is the...
He's the man.
Of the mountain, Dr. Yaldo. Call 1-800-398-EYES, 1-800-398-EYES, or go to YaldoEyeCenter.com. And, of course, great friends of the show, American Coney Island, celebrating 102 years. It's Detroit's oldest family-run restaurant and birthplace of the famous Detroit Coney Dog.
Delicious.
Mustard and Vidalia onions. And it's my personal favorite, Bob's.
Oh, I love it.
Mannequin Joe don't eat it. He don't even talk, do you, Joe?
You guys couldn't see him, but he was mouthing no.
Yes, the dust fell off his lips. You want a piece of Detroit, head downtown at the corner of Lafayette and Michigan Avenue. Can't miss it. It's the red, white, and blue building shaped like a slice of pie that I have freshly painted. Always delicious.
It looks great, too.
Thank you, doesn't it?
I was just down there the other day.
It does look good.
It does. Looks good.
I'm very, very
you did
proud
a nice
of
job.
It. The place is super, super clean, man.
Very clean.
Super clean.
The bathrooms are clean.
The bathrooms, the basement, everything.
Everything.
Everything. It's tip-top, grade A. You can check the health report. You can see that for all your restaurants in Detroit. Go to the health
report.
Right
on.
It's grade A. And always delicious. Always open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The dogs snap when you bite them, and the chili is a 100-year-old family recipe made especially for the American Coney dog, and the beer is cold.
Oh, the beer is cold.
And the Coney dog got invented because in 1917, Detroit was the first state in the Union 2 years before Prohibition to make alcohol illegal. So old Grandpa Caro's opened a gambling room and a speak down in the bottom of American Coney.
So you can get your beer?
Well, you know, man, like when you're gambling all day and you're drinking all day, you need something to eat. So he went to Brooklyn, Coney Island when he was 16 years old and one pair of shoes, saw Nathan's Hot Dog Emporium, thought that what America was. And then when he opened his speakeasy and started serving hot dogs with the special meat
sauce.
With
the chili on top.
He called it American Coney Island.
Nice.
It's gangster, man, and it is good.
It's been good for over 100 years.
Listen, visit the Detroit restaurant or the one in the D Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas or Hey Dad's, the Detroit Zoo. They sell beer there, too. Or order a Coney Island kit straight to your or a friend's door. Go to AmericanConeyIsland.com.
Don't let your friends go without Coney's.
Bob, you just snappy with all that stuff.
I'm telling you.
Hey, Willie, you on the phone? Bob, I think you hit your head when you fell off the motorcycle, too. Hey, Willie, you on the phone?
I'm on the phone.
Good. Thanks for joining us. Let me set this up, Willie. The big news in town is the debate over facial recognition software that the police have secretly been using for a couple of years. No protocols, no standards, no debate on it. Facial recognition software, usually, according to one study, 96% of the time in London, produced false positives, meaning innocent citizens were flagged as potential criminals 96% of the time, and it gets worse the darker your skin tone. Now we're talking about Detroit.
And if you're a woman.
And yes. And if you're an African-American woman, 30% of the times, according to a study, they think you're a guy.
Wow.
So
it don't work.
So maybe. Well, let's discuss that. But now what the mayor did, he comes out, because this guy's a puss, he comes out on with a social media video. You come out, you talk to us, you talk to Willie. He says they're not using live stream video technology. They're not monitoring people. Okay, well, here's what you're doing. You're using still photos from live stream video technology.
Yeah.
And shut the fuck up.
Right.
With the parsing here.
Yeah, you're arguing over semantics.
That's what you're doing. Now, Willie, you, sir, police commissioner elected by the people of the 5th District, 100,000 people, Willie Burton on the phone. Willie is actually a friend of the Constitution. Right, Willie?
Absolutely.
So Willie's, hey, they're going to vote on it. And Willie wants to make some points clear. And Willie gets arrested. Willie, let me play a little bit of this. This is a public meeting. You're a public official. And
at the meeting.
And the chair feels that you're being disruptive. And here's what the police brass do. Here, a little.
Damn, he's getting taken down. Pulling him out of his chair.
God damn. That's serious. All right, Bob, bring it down, Bob.
That is serious.
Willie, man, this is a huge issue and the whole world is watching. What was going on there? Why'd they haul you out?
You know, is this to the point where looking at free speech, you know, freedom of speech, and when your free speech is being shut down as an elected body, members of this body, you know, they disenfranchising 100,000 people that live in my district, which is the 5th District. You know, when you throw me out of a meeting, you're also throwing them out. You're throwing their voices out. You know, you got people that march and die for we to have the liberties, the freedoms and the liberties that we have today. You know, and these folks went out, they cast their ballots, they elected me to be their representative. And as I speak up, this is what happens to me. You know, two questions that I raised, which was good questions, Charlie. One of the questions was, what are you going to do as chairwoman that you didn't do before when you was the past chair or even the previous chair? What are you going to do differently? Well, we saw what happened differently, didn't we? I get hauled to the floor, kicked out of a meeting, dragged out in handcuffs, down to the detention center. So, you know, that was my most embarrassing moment, Charlie.
Well, Willie, were you charged with anything?
Disorderly conduct.
Did they actually charge you?
I had to be bailed out for $100 bail.
Did they charge you with
it? It was a bail bond, and
they charge you with resisting.
Then come to find out, charges is dropped.
Charges were dropped.
Days later. Pardon me?
Well, that's one way to clear the meeting, Willie. But look, let's go like this. What were you supposed... You were going to vote on accepting facial recognition as an official city policy, correct?
Well, I will say this. I did try to get the second sentence in. Second point, what happens when facial recognition misidentify a person of color or anyone? It doesn't have to be a person of color, black or brown. It could be somebody white. You know, what happens when facial recognition misidentify any person, any American, you know, who doesn't have the resources for a good legal defense? Remind you, the city of Detroit still has a 40% poverty rate.
Yeah, that's, look, here's what I want to know.
And all of a sudden, I'm out of order because I raised that question right there. But that was the question right there. That bounced out to me.
You were all going to vote on what? Did they give you a directive, a policy, you know, a procedural document? What were you voting on?
You know, Charlie, you know, they wanted to have a discussion on supporting the facial recognition. All of my colleagues was pretty much on board, except for three of us, except for myself. One of the commissioners from District 7 and also District 1, the three of us, we definitely were against it.
But again, Willie.
What were we voting on? Was this to accept?
Where was the document? What was the draft policy? For instance, right? They've been secretly using this for 2 years. The city council actually approved the purchase of this software. So our representatives knew. But where's the codification? Where are the protocols? Where are the rules? Where's the data? They've been doing it for 2 years. How effective is it?
You know, that's one of the things I raised at previous meetings. You know, what happened? You know, who in the department have access to this data? Who outside of the department will have access to it? We saw what happened with Edward Snowden, who leaked classified documents.
From the NSA.
Who was a contractor with the NSA. Not to mention how much data has been collected year to date, you know, or up to this day.
Yeah, but again, look. Under the Patriot Act, Congress, our representatives, got together and wrote new anti-terrorism laws. In order to even eavesdrop on an American, there's a special secret court, but there is a court.
ISA court.
Here, right, exactly. Here, who's to say they're not going to... Look, I've got a very flimsy transmittal here, a written directive. If we all go downtown to the fireworks... It's up to the chief to decide if they're going to start sweeping our faces, right? They're going to just the chief, under what circumstances?
And how are they using it?
Right, and by what law?
And Charlie,
where's the discussion on this?
Charlie, that's illegal and that's wrong. You know, but here it is. You have an oversight body should be in place to oversight the police department when they do things that are wrong. And that's illegal. You know,
that's who you are.
And you got hauled out of the
And the moment I speak up, I raise my hand, I get called upon the chair, you know, hey, chaos. You know, Charlie, I have never seen anything like this
Willie,
in my life.
Willie, have there ever been, look, again, the false positives. And we know the software is poor.
People get misidentified all the time, Charlie. Look what happened in New York. You have an 18-year-old student who was just recently wrongfully arrested. Now the family is suing Apple for $1 billion. The city of Detroit just got out of bankruptcy, Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also just got out of a 13-year federal consent decree. You know, what happens when this backfires on the city of Detroit? What happens when you have elected officials that know something is wrong and don't speak up?
Well, let me.
I'm speaking up.
Let me go like this.
You were speaking up, and they tried to shut you down.
Well, they did shut him down.
They did shut him down.
All right,
down.
So come on. Let's get that some shit here. Yes, he's been arrested. They shut him up. Here's the thing, Willie.
Drag me to the floor.
Here's the thing, Willie.
In a humane way, treating me like a criminal.
And you're a police commissioner.
And I'm a police commissioner.
Isn't that ironic? Now, listen, Willie.
Listen.
The FBI was doing this. FBI, same thing. You know what Congress said last month? Hey, what was that committee? The Committee on Oversight and Reform. They said there should probably be some kind of restrictions. It's time for a time out. Unanimously, Republicans, Democrats on this subcommittee, black, white, brown, voted unanimously to take this to the whole body. Wait a minute. The police don't just do what the police want to do because we're Americans.
Right.
And it's embedded in us. I love this country. I love the form of government. I don't trust those occupying the chairs. You're not the king chief. You're not the emperor mayor. The rest of the world's not even doing it. They're looking to us. You know, what are your rules and data and the codification?
Doing.
And what are we doing? We're tossing Willie into the can, and Mike's posting shit on Facebook that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
You're doing it for me too, Willie, because I drive through Detroit a lot. I'm a brown-skinned guy. And if you can take this software and recalibrate it, because right now the majority of people, where do they get these pictures? Your driver's license? Social media, your mugshots, anything. We're all now in the mugshot book, right?
Right.
You know, it's so wrong. And now every American, everybody that's come to the city of Detroit, whether you're visiting or from here or whatever the case may be, you are now under a public virtual lineup. Part of a DPD's virtual lineup.
It's illegal search and seizure.
And who wants to be in a virtual
amendment.
Lineup?
Yeah.
Fourth Amendment. I think I'm going to be honest with you, Will. Let's just see how we go here. Because, again, you're the power, but you're not the power. I'm the power, but we're all the power. This is how we do it.
Well, we're the people.
In principle, you know, I'm not sure I have a problem with taking public pictures and running them through looking for a criminal. Bob's like, I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, I don't know. But guess what? Here, surprise, surprise. I don't know if you know this, Mr. Commissioner. The Detroit police have been doing this for years and years, and the state police do it. All they do now is take the still picture, or up to 2 years ago, they take the still picture and send it to the state police. Then the state police sends you back 8 potential hits. Did you know that, Willie?
Nope.
And yep, what are they comparing their pictures
to? No bullshit news. This is where you get the stuff.
Are they comparing it to like driver's license photos?
Yes, Facebook photos. Like if you've ever been arrested, all kinds of stuff.
Well, and you haven't done anything, so that's why I say it's illegal
search. So isn't an invasion of privacy? I'm down at the fireworks. I might match, and they're looking for somebody, and they, sir, come with me. You know what I do as an American? The fuck, on what grounds?
Right.
Why'd you pull me over, officer? Get the fuck on.
Well, and that's just exactly it. So if they get a hit, right, on your picture from the fireworks, then they're coming to your door, knock, knock, knock. Hey, let me in. We got to talk, you know, got a warrant for your arrest.
Okay, Willie, listen. We got a little soundbite here. The chief of police has now, he's coming out to explain how this works in his data that nobody's seen. So here's the, do we have a Bob? Here's the chief's explanation at a press conference.
But I will tell you, using this technology, we cannot And we will not ever arrest somebody solely on facial recognition match.
Why a year and a half later? Is this
because we want to frame policy. We will operate.
Why didn't it happen before?
It just didn't happen. 30% of the 500 times that we've done this have moved on to the next level in the investigation. Only 30%.
Only.
And there's not been a mismatch.
What the fuck does that mean, Willie? Do you have any... Look, well, let's just go back over that again. 30% of the time, only 30% of the time has it gone on to the next level.
Right.
Which is what? You're continuing the investigation? So it's failed 70% of the time? But then you say there's never been a mismatch? I don't understand. See,
how could there never be a mismatch if it only worked one out of three times?
I'm thinking, Willie, what I imagine you is you got your coat off, you got your tie undone, your collar's open, the sleeves are rolled up, you're in a committee meeting for hours and hours, and you're studying this, and you're getting experts from Washington and the FBI and Georgetown University, and you're really trying to craft a policy that goes A, B, C, like the Patriot Act. But we don't. We have a pile of shit. They didn't even give you a document, did they?
You know, only thing that we got that I recall receiving, I received something in my folder once. And it was a few weeks ago, Charlie. I can't really give you the dates,
Not important
under all of the things that I've been dealing with, you know, here from last week up until now. But I received something in my folder about traffic mounted cameras and facial recognition. It was like one policy, Charlie. And we get this at the 12th hour. And so, you know, when you get something at the 12th hour, you say, hold on, why are we going to be voting on this when we haven't had hardly any public forums or discussions on this? So what I did was I called for a special town hall meeting on a Wednesday. And then had the people to show up to the police board commissioner's meeting on the Thursday and, you know, express their concerns. So you had about, 38, 40 people come to the mic for public comment, express their concerns. They don't want it.
The Congress coming up with it. Look, there's no policy.
Another time we get about 18 people, these are approximately numbers. That comes up and say, we don't want it. One was a community meeting. The other one was at a Board of Police Commissioners meeting.
Let me do the mayor a favor here, because you know what? He's in a lot of shit. And I don't... Look, folks, you're listening to the show because you're getting the alternative non-lollipop presentation of what's really going on.
Bullshit.
Thanks, Bob. Here's the deal. The mayor's, you know, he went in because I know your staff, Mayor. I know what you're doing. Here's what you asked. How do I deal with this? So, look, man, the mayor's on the run here, Willie, because the questions you ask and the way you ask them are proper, in my opinion. He asks what he should do. Nobody has an answer. So he comes out with we're not using live. There's no facial recognition equipment in the cameras. No, sir, there isn't. It all funnels into your computer back at headquarters where there's the facial recognition. It's stupid. So here's what you do, sir. You call a moratorium on this. The city's not happy. The suburbs aren't particularly happy. Congress isn't happy. You tell them you're going to do some work. You're going to roll up your sleeve. You're going to study the data you haven't bothered to collect or give to the people. And then you let it fade away until a real city with real operators can study this thing. That about right?
Hey, you know, the city of Detroit shouldn't be using it at all. We shouldn't even be experimenting with our residents, with our people.
We already
here.
Did.
For 2 years.
You already did. How many times
another
it
another thing is, when they give us something that's a 12th hour, like traffic-mounted cameras and facial recognition in one policy at the 12th hour, and say we're going to be voting on this in a week or two, when were you going to notify the public? When were you going to get the public's input?
Willie, you're the one that
gonna have time
put
to
this
do
out
their
there.
Due diligence to sit down with their constituents and walk through this whole process. But when was the commissioners going to be notified that DPD was using this in the first place? Exactly. We should have been the first people or first elected body to have known their plans, whether they were going to use something like this. It should have been talked about with us. We should have seen experts coming in from people that have
from around the country. That's
statistics on this around the world. Somebody should have came in from DC. Somebody should have came in from the FBI. Somebody should have came in from some universities, whether it's Harvard, Georgetown, Princeton, you name them. You know, somebody who has data on this. You know, but we haven't talked to any of these experts. You know who we've been hearing from lately? CPD.
Yep.
Saying
the
this
users.
Is what they're about to do. They're about to roll this out. And now we are laughing city because we've been using this shit for what, a year and a half, Charlie? Two years?
Mm-hmm.
And the police board of commissioners didn't know about it. It makes us look like we a joke.
Well, we are
It makes it look like we a joke because we are, we doesn't have a seat at the table making real sound decisions.
Right. Now, let me say, Willie.
And here's, the commissioners are the puppets.
Here's the thing, Willie. Detroit is capital city. We all go to Detroit. It affects all of us. And what Detroit does, right, we follow. We will follow this technology. I'd like it to be, you know, thought out. But so let me do this. Watch this. Facial recognition after a crime has been committed. Everybody listen. Facial recognition after a crime has been committed does not stop the crime from being committed. So let me tell you how to
deter a crime.
Let me tell you how to, Lily, let me give you another statistic. Super cops. I talked to three of them last night. They called me. Super cops. Real ones. Ones you support. Ones that get these guys. Here's the number. It's been 4 weeks of summer. 28 days. 4 weeks. 1 month. We've had 138 shootings in Detroit. 138.
How many of those fatal?
Last year, on average, we had about 60 a month. We've had 138. You know why? Because here's the thing, Willie. We might diverge on this. The real problem with the fake statistics and the carousel command staff and all of that shit is the unspoken word is hands off, don't touch anybody. There's an acceptable body count because the policing's not getting done. The super cops told me that. And I know.
Charlie, let me ask
138. This Chicago had, just times that by four. Times that by four. 140, 140, 280, 550 shootings in a month. Go ahead, Willie, sorry.
Charlie, you know, just last year, I asked, I asked the question. I said, about the most violent crime stats, I looked at 2015, 16, 17 up, 2014 up to 2018 or something. There was disparity with how DPD reported out on their data.
Yeah.
You know,
they kept
MSP,
changing it.
Which is Michigan State Police. They say one thing, our data is one, it's one way when it comes to,
yes.
And then DPD reports something totally different.
And then the FBI glitch. Yeah, the computer glitch, and then the FBI refused to accept the numbers. Yes, it's unacceptable. That's what we report here. That's the truth.
And this goes back against transparency. You know, where is the transparency here? We can't trust the government. If the people cannot trust the government, they cannot trust their law enforcement to do what's right, and they reported out fabricated numbers, then who do you trust, Charlie?
That's the thing. I don't want to lose faith. See, a democracy only stands when there's open and free information. That's, again, look, I'll tell you what. I'm glad for those Bill of Rights. You want to know what? If it wasn't for the First Amendment, right, freedom of the press, Duggan and
freedom
or
of speech,
right?
Freedom of liberty.
Duggan and or his associates have on numerous occasions sued me, attempted to sue me, asked for letters of retraction and defamation. I'm glad the founding fathers put that in because they knew this kind of stuff is perpetual, right? It's an open society. It's not what's going on down there. Willie, listen, what we got to go here, but what's the next step in all this?
before I get there in closing, Charlie, I wanted to say Detroiters, you know, they want to see the police ride through their neighborhoods, you know, solve crime. They want to see police response time improve. You know, we still above the national average when we should be a city that's underneath the national average. The fact that the department has been hiring, you know, 30-some new officers per month approximately. They like to see the police more visible in the neighborhoods, not at a police board of commissioners meeting, dragging out elected officials in handcuffs, not at a charter commissioner meeting. There's more police officers at charter commissioner meetings and police board of commissioners than there is in a neighborhood that's patrolling.
By the way, Willie,
the city has to get back to old-fashioned policing.
By the way,
not
Willie,
using facial recognition, but out there,
I know you hear me. I know you hear me, Willie. So listen, here's the other one. When they went to take you to the Pokey, it's now a central lockup facility. How'd you like sitting in that car for half an hour? How'd you like waiting in line? Did you notice all the police not on the streets, but like at central booking? Do you realize that police commissioner,
Charlie,
there's a problem there.
It was uncomfortable sitting in the car with your hands behind your back. You know, you can barely breathe.
Because there's a line,
you know,
dude. There's an inefficiency there.
Then it's hot as hell.
Yeah.
You know, but,
and it's dangerous for the cop.
I can't hear you, Charlie.
And it's dangerous for the cop to be sitting with a prisoner in the back of the car waiting in line.
Getting agitated.
Taking 2 or 3 hours to book one prisoner. There's no police on the street. There's a lot of shit going on, sir. So listen, we got to go. We'll be in touch with you. Don't fight the power. You are the power. Don't get in a fight with them. Be rational. Be reasonable. And it's the civil liberties of all of us.
Keep fighting for what's right.
Sam told me to tell you he liked your article. He said the next article, he's going to write one on you.
Deadline Detroit. I did write I'm starting to believe this is Comeback City. DeadlineDetroit.com. It's Comeback City, all right. It's starting to look like 2010. Sam Riddle's on the scene. Bob Ficano is your defense attorney, the former chief of police who got fired for, you know, making a sizzle reel for a cable TV show saying with a semi-automatic in his hand saying, I'll do whatever it takes.
Now he's got his own jail deal.
Now he's the Wayne County executive. That jail deal, the new one, is $75 million over budget, and there's no foundation yet, right? And then we got Duggan driving around in a Ford, like we had Kilpatrick driving around in a Ford, and they both had grand juries and electronic messages to their girlfriends. Damn it.
It's Comeback City.
They all got their bodyguards, man. I mean, I've never seen so many people, elected officials, with so many bodyguards, man, you know.
Hey, dude, one last thing. By the way, those guys that were arresting you, I noticed they're like police brass.
They were all dudes.
Top brass.
They were top brass. The assistant chief of police was right there.
Commander took my hand and twisted it all to the back, and, you know, they dragged me to the floor, man. You know, it's just...
That's just how dangerous you are, Willie.
Bad man, Willie.
Dangerous.
And now our democracy, they're trying to shut down a democracy and shut down free speech, man, and hog off elected officials to jail. These are dangerous times that we are living in. I mean, this is a dangerous city, dangerous time when they shoot down your democracy, and...
And the cameras are everywhere.
For all of the listeners out there, stand up. Stand up for what's right. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you,
guys.
Okay.
Thank you, Willie.
We'll be in touch.
Keep it up.
Wow, man. Well, you know what? One of the last honest people in Detroit. ADR Consultants, providing full business, construction, and IT consulting services for your company, municipality, and law enforcement agency. ADR experienced, overseeing more than $250 million in private and public construction projects since 2001. Need to reduce costs? Need to re-engineer processes? Or find better vendors? Wink, wink, the new jail and court complex? ADR can save clients millions. ADR Consultants are experts in procurement, compliance, and minority participation. Honest, ethical, smart. Call Barry Ellentalk at 248-318-9424 for a consultation. Get the job right, on time, on budget. Barry Ellentalk, ADR Consultants, 248-318-9424. And Hall Financial, They offer lower rates, better options than that. Personal attention you want when talking about your home. The average refi takes 44 days. Hall Financial averages 19 days. Do the math. That's half the time. Email dhall at hallfg.com to get the paper moving. I am thinking about blowing out my kitchen. And I might need to take some equity out of the house and get that done. So, David, it's time to get that coffee. 248-308-5000. Or maybe you just want to do what I'm doing. You don't want a mortgage. You want to take some equity out or shorten the length of your mortgage. You could be less than 3 weeks from saving money with Hall Financial. Email dhall at hallfg.com or call 248-308-5000. Tell them you heard it on the No BS News, right? Or the Drew and Mike podcast or all of our other shows. Because Red Shovel Network. Because I appreciate him giving us and the network a shot. ML Elric, Eli, Denny. NMLS number 1467435, Hall Financial. You won't be disappointed. Now, we didn't have Tim Alberta last week, did we? Right?
No.
Well, guess what, guys? His book is rocking. It's on the bestseller list. He's doing all the news shows.
He's naming names and pointing fingers.
Yeah, and Trump is going crazy on Twitter over what Paul Ryan, the former Speaker of the House, was said about him. Yeah. I mean, it is a great book. Like, this isn't just another one of those palace intrigue books. This is one of those books that not only tells you the palace intrigue, but it chronicles
history,
the change in the Republican Party. Because Trump is not, even though he owns country clubs, the people he's attracting are definitely, it's not the good old boy, the tax cuts and conservative values and, you know, liberal immigration policies to keep wages low. It's changed. He was there through the whole collapse of it.
Yeah.
And then he also sort of augurs the same thing for the Democrats now. Because you see.
Sure.
You see what Trump's doing with the Gang of Four.
Right.
The squad.
The squad.
He's trying to make the far left the main
face of the Democratic Party.
Right. So this whole shit is like, is it for us or is it about winning? What?
Well, and the great thing for Tim is that the more Trump talks about his book, the more sales go up, I'm sure.
Exactly.
You know, so it's like, you know, if you don't want anybody to be drawing attention to the book, quit talking about it.
I think Trump likes the book.
I mean, he likes anything that talks about him, you know, that's got him as the centerpiece.
So let me just say this. Tim, Brighton native, MSU grad, the senior political writer for Political Magazine, and the Capitol Hill and White House correspondent for the No Bullshit News Hour. We recorded this earlier in the week because his schedule's so tight right now. Mark Fellauer was working the board, just so you're caught up. And let's just roll that interview, Bob. Oh, and Tim, we'll see you for the debates, bro. Hey, I want to welcome a good friend of the show, Brighton's own Tim Alberta, the chief political writer at Political Magazine and the No Bullshit News Hour White House and congressional correspondent. He's got a new book out called American Carnage, out today, right, Tim?
That's right.
Congratulations, dude. I know it's a labor of love.
Thanks, brother. You've done it before. You've done it well. So, you know, it's kind of stressful and exciting and terrifying all at the same time.
Before we get started, you went to Michigan State, right?
Yeah. Well, I went to Schoolcraft. I started Schoolcraft, and then I transferred to
State. Yeah, I went to Schoolcraft for a class. But did you hear, just because of the whole fuck-up with Larry Nassar, they're going to, for PR purposes, change the fight song at Michigan State?
Wait, they're going to do what?
They're going to change the fight song because of the PR problems up there. You didn't hear that?
No, are you messing with me?
No, listen, here's what they're going to change it to. Goldfinger. Oh, yeah, go blue. Goldfinger, bro.
And I thought you called this the No Bullshit News Hour for nothing.
Well, we got to keep it happy, keep it fun. It's not fun, though. It's not funny. It's too soon. Okay, look, man. American Carnage. Dude, I'm almost done. It's 600 pages. It's excellent. Now, let me just set it up. I don't think it's just a book about the intrigue and the backstabbing and the name-calling and the whispers in the Trump White House. It's also a book really about the Republican Party over the last two decades, how it weakened, how it collapsed, how it became leaderless and rudderless, and finally fully gave in to Trump. Now, a major theme in this book, Tim, is that every leader in the party, it seems, has bent the knee to Trump. So my question is, why did they cave? Expediency?
Well, expediency is a part of it, but I also think, Charlie, whether you love Trump or hate him, you've got to give him credit for being pretty prescient in one regard. He saw pretty early on what a lot of Republican voters were coming around to see in the post-George W. Bush Republican era, which is basically that the party was weak, the party was soft, the party was populated by leaders who didn't really stand for anything, didn't really have many convictions. They were just kind of going along to get along. They were looking out for the few at the expense of many. And Trump, who his own policies in office have betrayed his rhetoric when campaigning for president, but here comes this guy on the scene who says, listen, the little guy's getting screwed. The political system is most of the governed. And he promises to basically, you know, burn down the government on behalf of all these pissed off people around the country who feel like both parties have sold them a bill of goods. And, you know, there's no overstating just how effective it was for an outsider to come along at this time. And you know, the man has to make the moment of politics. We know that, you know, whether it's Obama or Clinton or whoever, you have to have the timing right. And Donald Trump's timing was impeccable when he came down that escalator in 2015. And started in on trade, started in on immigration, started in on globalization, the outsourcing of jobs, and how all these corporations are basically abusing the American social contract. He captured perfectly all of this anxiety, all this anger, this bitterness, this resentment that had been sort of stewing in the country for a couple of decades, and the timing was just right for this populist takeover of the Republican Party.
But we know that. I mean, but why does it take an orange guy living in a brass penthouse to put it together?
Oh, the hell of a question. I mean, look, you want the simple answer?
Yes.
Charlie, I think it's this. I think that the Republican Party in the post-Reagan era was lazy. It was intellectually complacent. They stopped listening to voters and just sort of took for granted, you know, whatever they read on the Wall Street editorial page and whatever the stock index has told them and whatever, you know, the luncheon at the country club or at the Chamber of Commerce, they all kind of walk in and do their thing and they collect the checks and they go back to Washington and resume business as usual. And there was this assumption, this sort of overriding assumption that, you know, on balance, things like, you know, NAFTA and things like, you know, really liberalized immigration policies that were allowing, you know, huge influx of cheap labor, that they were good for the American economy at large. And, you know, they weren't wrong about that. A lot of corporations were seeing their profits take off. There was more money, more GDP sort of, you know, pumping through the economy as a whole. The stock market was improving. But for individuals, you know, wages are stagnating and jobs are disappearing. In an 18-month stretch from the end of the Bush presidency through the beginning of the Obama presidency, you had 2 million manufacturing jobs lost in that 18-month stretch. 15% of the entire U.S. manufacturing workforce vanished in 18 months. And for those people, they don't really give a shit about, you know, 401ks being up. They don't really give a shit about corporate profits and GDP and net exports being an all-time high. They just know that their communities are hollowed out and that they're trying to get a job at Applebee's to feed their kids.
Then no, there's no doubt about that, man. But and here, look, this isn't – you've been – hanging out with Republicans for a decade. I mean, inside. And so here's what this book's doing. I mean, it's out today, but it's already blowing up. There's a couple of things that you get directly from the former speaker, Paul Ryan. He says, quote, Trump didn't know anything about government. And then he says, we've gotten so numb by it all, speaking about Trump's behavior, that not in government, but where we live our lives, we have a responsibility to try to rebuild. Don't call a woman a horse face. Don't cheat on your wife. Don't cheat on anything. Be a good person. Set an example. To which Trump fires back now, after your book's release, that people like Ryan almost killed the Republican Party because they're weak, ineffective, and stupid. So, did Trump expose who the Republicans really are, or is this what the Republicans now are? Who owns this party?
Well, Trump owns the party, and look, I think that it's funny, Charlie. I mean, if you break down what Ryan had to say about Trump, and if you broke down what Trump had to say about Ryan, you'd probably find some truth in both, right? Because what Ryan is saying is, look, you know,
forget about Donald Trump for a minute, and I got to emphasize, this book is not about Donald Trump. It's not meant to hold up a mirror to Donald Trump and say, you know, what is in this man's soul? The book is actually meant to hold up a mirror to us, to the country, because we elected him, and frankly, we produced this environment that was conducive to his political rise in the first place. If you want to reckon with Trumpism, if you want to reckon with this moment in American politics, if you want to look at everything that's happening right now in the country, all of the polarization, all the disunity, the self-hatred going on in this country, if you want to take all that and if you want to lay it at Trump's doorstep, you are free to do so, but I think it's a big, big mistake, because Trump is going to come and go, but all of these forces in our society that brought him into the White House are still going to be there. We're still going to have to reckon with it. So I think that's what Ryan is trying to get at. You know, America more or less got the president that she deserves, right? In an age when the Kardashians are the most famous people on earth and our culture has sort of, you know, lost its way as far as, you know, communities helping one another and people looking out for each other. You wind up with a guy like Donald Trump in the White House. But what he has to say about Paul Ryan is also true to an extent, where he said, look, you had these guys like Paul who basically spent their entire lives in Congress looking out for corporations and sort of, you know, adhering to the Ronald Reagan playbook, just focused on tax cuts and deregulation and everything else without, you know, without trying to pin it back at a really ground level to all of these people who want to vote Republican but who are being really hurt by Republican policies. And again, the irony of that, of course, is that Trump, after taking office, has been a pretty traditional Republican in terms of his policymaking. One could argue that his tax bill was standard Republican fare and was actually disproportionately helpful to the wealthy at the expense of the working and middle class. That's a whole different conversation.
I don't think that's an argument. I think that's the truth.
Right.
The disarray that the Republican Party might have been in, where they're looking for someone to take charge, say 2014, 2015, how does that compare and contrast to where maybe the Democrats are today with a lot of the infighting that they see between the different factions within their party?
Well, there are some pretty eerie parallels. And look, I don't think that we see a 500-pound gorilla on the left right now, you know, who can channel the forces of Trumpism, not yet anyway, but Nancy Pelosi has her hands full, man, and she is in some ways sort of a mirror image of where John Boehner was at this point 8 years ago. He's trying to deal with this insurrection. He's got this insurgency of, you know, dozens of young conservative lawmakers come to Congress, and they're ready to burn this place down and piss on the ashes. And they don't care about playing by the rules. They're not trying to, you know, adhere to the conventions of Washington. They don't really have much respect for the institutions of government. And that is pretty much where Pelosi is now in dealing with a lot of these young progressive firebrands. And look, a lot of these people, they mean well. And you appreciate people who at least do come from the outside and try to break up the status quo, because the status quo ain't working. But there's got to be a balance struck, obviously, because government needs to work. Government needs to function. You have to have people who can get in a room together with very different worldviews and very different ideologies and still, at the end of the day, keep the lights on and make sure that the trains are running on time. And there's a real struggle with that in the Democratic Party right now. And it's going to be very interesting to see over the next year and a half, you know, who the Democrats nominate for their presidential candidate. And frankly, once they nominate that person, is Trump able to define the race on his terms? Is he able to use Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and some of these other young progressive women in the Democratic caucus, is he able to paint the party as a party of socialism, as a party of extremism, as a party that is, you know, way outside the mainstream of American thought? Is he able to accomplish that, or do Democrats not take that bait? I think that's what Pelosi is obviously most worried about, and that's why you see so much friction on that side of the aisle right now.
I think, you know, look, you said he's acted pretty much like a standard bearer from the Republican Party, not so much on immigration, because that was, they were pretty laissez-faire about immigration. In fact, you know, McCarthy out of Bakersfield, I interviewed his neighbor's gardener, you know, an illegal. And then when you're in, you know, the San Joaquin Valley, he's not about zipping up the border. But here's where I think the Democrats get in trouble when it comes to general election time. Trump's already stolen half their platforms. Trade, right? Jobs, manufacturing jobs. So where do they move? Do they talk about health care? Do they talk about global warming? I don't really think those are strong issues.
Well, I think health care is. I would disagree with you on that.
I don't think that's at the top of my list, though.
Well, look, if you go back to 2018, so here's the thing. You have to think about the Republican coalition that elected Trump and basically cut it in half, right? About half of that coalition are your more sort of conservative, in many cases rural and exurban blue-collar workers who are, you know, seem to be, in many cases, if you trust polling, more enthusiastically supportive of the president, right? And then the other half of the coalition are more of the sort of white-collar, suburban, wealthy, socially moderate, or even maybe socially progressive Republicans who are kind of those country club types who, you know, they voted for Trump to get the tax cuts and maybe to get some conservative judges, but they wish he would stop tweeting and they're kind of tired of all this shit. And the real question is, Trump is, you know, really keen on mobilizing that group of true believers on the one side. But there's a risk, obviously, if he goes too far of alienating the other side of that coalition. But then, on the other side, if Democrats nominate somebody who's going to talk about trying to, you know, privatize insurance and basically shut down the entire private insurance industry, as an example, or pass a Green New Deal where they're going to have a mandatory, you know, living wage or whatever some of these different ideas that you're circulating in the Democratic Party are right now, that's going to be manna from heaven to Trump. Because you're right, in some way, Charlie, he has stolen the traditional Democratic platform of, you know, on trade and on globalization being harmful to American workers. It wasn't that long ago that Democrats were the party that was really worried about a mass influx of cheap labor coming across the border. Mm-hmm. And now the Democratic Party is almost allowing itself to be defined by this open borders argument about decriminalizing crossing the border, which I think is just politically suicidal next
month. Now, dude, think, Mark wants to say something, but I just want everybody to think for a second. Look how everything's upended. Everything's just on its fucking ear. You can't make heads or tails of anything. Where we're going, who we are, you know.
Well, the one thing I'm amazed at with the Republican Party, with Trump at the head, is how they have maintained the control, or at least the support, of the Christian
evangelicals.
The evangelicals, and you write a lot about Trump lashing out at the so-called Christians, and Pence was worried about it. How has he maintained their support? Is it simply two Supreme Court justices?
You know, it's really interesting. This is obviously a subject of fascination for a lot of people, and I actually think it's not super complicated, guys. Here's the answer. It's transactional. I think Trump is the ultimate transactional politician, and I think at some point along the line, you know, a lot of evangelicals will openly admit that, you know, that they were too idealistic back in the day, thinking that, you know, that they needed these moral leaders in government. And, you know, when they complained about Bill Clinton, you know, running around with Monica Lewinsky, and when they demanded this sort of purity in government and they wanted, you know, their commander-in-chief to be sort of a preacher-in-chief, I think a lot of them started to look around. They realized that the culture is kind of decaying around them and that these standards they're looking for are sort of unrealistic. And a lot of them begin to sort of set that stuff aside and they say, okay, who's going to give us what we want? Who can we get the most out of? And Trump was not the first choice of a lot of these people. I think a lot of them preferred a Ted Cruz or maybe a Marco Rubio. But ultimately, when it came down to a binary choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and one person is promising to stock the federal judiciary, not just the Supreme Court, but all these appeals courts across the country, all these federal judicial vacancies, one person's promising to put pro-life conservatives on all those benches, and the other person is promising to put progressive pro-choice people on all those benches, that's a no-brainer for most of these evangelicals. And Trump really has delivered for that one section of the electorate, you could argue, more than anybody else. He has been, when you talk about his base, Trump is smart. He realizes that if he did not turn out these white evangelicals at record numbers in 2016, he would not be president today. So he has really gone out of his way time and time again on issues of abortion and religious liberty, you name it, transgenders in the military. He has tried to check that box constantly with the evangelicals. And basically, in that transaction, even when they see him doing things that are clearly, you know, sort of outside of their moral mainstream and things that they would have huge problems with if Obama was doing them or if any Democrat were doing them, they kind of turn a blind eye to it because they say, well, you know, we don't like this stuff, but this guy has given us all these other things that he promised he would give us. So I just think it's the ultimate transactional relationship. And is it ugly? Is it hypocritical? Is it cynical? Sure. But I think they're going to vote for him again in 2020.
Oh, yeah, they're going to. Dude, whose party is it now? Trump's more popular than members of Congress, right? His approval rating among Republicans is what? In the 90s?
Yeah, it's pretty consistently right around 90.
90. So, look, like we're in Michigan, right? Justin Amash, the Republican from the west side of the state, he breaks ranks on impeachment, and now he's had to quit the party after the party abandoned him. So, are the Republicans, have we always been like Trump, or were we always like Bush? Are we like redneck, irascible evangelicals who party on Saturday night, fight in a parking lot, and then in the front pew in church on Sunday? Or is it going to shift back to, you know, Fiorina and Bush and these kind of people?
And are we to believe Amash when he claims that there's other Republicans that have reached out to him on the down low to appreciate what he did? Because I don't know if I really believe that.
Oh, man, I believe it. With no question, I believe it because, look, you know, Charlie, you said earlier, I've been hanging around a lot of these cats for a long time, and I have. I mean, I covered Congress for a lot of years, and that's a lot of after hours, having beers with members of Congress, bullshitting off the record. I know a lot of these dudes, and I will tell you as a fact, as an absolute fact, take it to the bank, that most of these Republicans, not all of them, because there are some true believers, but most of these Republicans that you see on Fox News any given night out there defending Trump, full-throated, this is our guy, make America great again, he can do no wrong. When you get these guys in private and you're just shooting the shit with them off the record, they are intensely critical of this dude. They think that he's unhinged. They wish that he would just shut up. They want to get rid of his phone, get rid of his Twitter account. There are a lot of Republicans in D.C. who won't come out and say that publicly because they're scared of him. They're terrified of him. They understand, like Amash, who at least Amash has the balls to come out and call for impeachment because it's what he believes. And then Amash realized pretty quickly that he wasn't going to win his Republican primary, so he left the party. And he's going to obviously run a third party. He may win, he may not. But Amash saw what happened to guys like Mark Sanford, guys like Jeff Flake. Look, if you cross Donald Trump in today's Republican Party, it's a death sentence. Period. Full stop. I mean, the debates within the party are no longer about ideology. It's not about the size of government. It's not about, you know, are you a conservative or a moderate? It's a binary choice. Are you with Trump or are you against Trump?
Dig it,
that
dude.
That is the new fault line.
But there's, look, that just tells me what the Republican Party's always been, and I've always said it. The country club convinced the redneck, that, and it was through racial politics, that this is the way you should go. Because the only thing the country club offered the working class white was getting rid of affirmative action, which they never did, right? And now Trump comes along and says, look, they've sold you out. Not only is affirmative action still here and someone else gets an extra point, the value of your house, well, it's come back, but everybody's afraid that it's not real. Your jobs are gone. Your brother or cousin that went to the foreign wars are back on popsicle sticks and can't get an appointment at the VA. That's what he managed to do. And that's probably what's happening on the left, right? Who really represents you?
Look, no doubt. I mean, what I said a minute ago about these old divisions in the Republican Party sort of falling away and it not being about ideology anymore, I think that's the case. And lift up from that and expand it out to the entire country. I mean, policy and ideology aren't even really the debate at all anymore in any of this. It's almost all cultural, right? I mean, look at the last 72 hours with the president and his tweet and the backlash to it and the dueling news conferences. I mean, you know, and again,
explain the tweet. Explain the tweet for people that, you know, who live under a rock might
sure.
not know.
So you guys are in Detroit, right? So Rashida Tlaib, your freshman congresswoman, she's born in Detroit. Obviously, her family is Palestinian roots. And so she is a member of this young core of House Democratic women. They are freshman lawmakers, and they are very progressive. There's four of them. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York and Ilhan Omar from Minnesota and Ayanna Pressley from Massachusetts. Those are the other three. These are all women of color. And Trump sends out this tweet basically saying to them in so many words, you know, go back to where you came from. Go back to the countries you came from. And obviously there are significant, you know, nativist and xenophobic undertones to what he's saying there. And so it sets off this firestorm in the Democratic Party and in parts of the Republican Party because people are really uncomfortable with this kind of rhetoric. But it's kind of a microcosm of Trump's entire takeover of the Republican Party because only a handful of people in the GOP worked up the courage to come out and say, you know what, this is racist.
and this is wrong, and the president should apologize. He shouldn't be saying stuff like this. But most of these other folks, they're hiding under the desk. They're not going to come out and say anything because it's this cultural forest fire, Charlie. But, you know, you can disagree with the president on tax cuts. You can disagree with him on health care. You can disagree with him on entitlement spending or some of the other
things. Even immigration levels.
Yeah. I mean, but look, if you want to get in the ring with him on these cultural issues, you're probably going to lose. And that's the terrain he wants 2020 fought on. It remains to be seen whether or not Democrats play into that.
It's stupid, man. Look, you can go like this. This is Tlaib and Cortez and the gang. You're whacked out. You're out of the mainstream. You could say that. But what are you talking about? Go back to where you come from. Your father was an immigrant. Your wife is an immigrant. It's an asshole thing to say. It is an asshole thing to say. I'm on the record. Tim, is it an asshole thing to say?
Yeah, of course. Come on.
Look at that. Nice. No bullshit.
No bullshit news hour. I mean, look, and again, this is the kind of thing, Charlie, where if you're a suburban, you know, there's this old kind of joke in Republican circles, and it's gone on for years. Whenever you see a Republican presidential candidate go to speak to the NAACP, and people would joke and say, why the hell is this guy going to speak to the NAACP? You know you're not going to pick up any more black votes by doing so. And the answer would be, no, he knows he's not going to gain more black votes, but he needs to pick up those suburban white votes, right? Because those are the people who are really sensitive to these issues. Those are the people who are, you know, who kind of cringe at this talk of racism and xenophobia and the rest. And so to my point earlier, I'm trying to bring this back full circle. Trump is trying to light this prayer fire on these sort of cultural issues, and he looks at these four young women of color, and he says, go back to where you came from, and he sees it firing up his base. And it probably does, but does it not also at the same time alienate a lot of those upscale, suburban, you know, college-educated country club Republicans who they don't want to hear that shit, and they don't want to be associated with that, and they're certainly not going to stay in polite company that, yeah, I support this guy. That's a very real risk for him.
Really is. I know you're busy. I know you're running around the country doing all kinds of media. It's a great book. Let me say it again. The full title is American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. It goes back in time. It goes forward. And it's a great accounting of the Republican Party. Let me say this. Most of our audience is either in Michigan or from Michigan. Do you agree that nobody's going to take the White House if you don't take Michigan? You got to clear Michigan. And Michigan is the home state of Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib and Congressman Justin Amash. So what do you augur here? What is the importance of Michigan?
It's ground zero, man. Look, Michigan was the smallest.
Say that again.
It's ground zero. Michigan is ground zero for 2020. It was the smallest margin of votes in the 2016 election. Donald Trump won the state by about 10,000 votes and change. Look, right behind it is Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. He won those three states, Charlie, by a combined 77,744 votes. I mean, that's fewer people than you can fit in the big house, right? That's not a big margin for three states. And if Trump doesn't win all three of those states, then he's not president today. So there's your margin. This campaign is going to be won and lost in the Rust Belt, and Michigan is going to be ground zero for the simple fact that Donald Trump won a state that had not been carried by Republicans since 1988. Mm-hmm. Right? Democrats had a stronghold in Michigan for a very long time, and there are an awful lot of people in the Democratic Party who feel like if they had not nominated Hillary Clinton, one of the weakest general election nominees in a century, that they would have won Michigan, that Donald Trump didn't win because of anything great he did, but basically he won because Hillary Clinton screwed it up. So do Democrats nominate somebody who can appeal to the middle of the electorate and to a lot of those disaffected voters who swung from Obama in 12 to Trump in 16, or do they nominate somebody who scares the shit out of a lot of those voters, somebody who is outside of the mainstream, or at least perceived to be outside of the mainstream? That is a very real question heading into 20, because, again, Democrats, they might just find a way to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory here, because Michigan is a state that, on paper, if you look at all these congressional seats that slipped last fall in Michigan alone in 2018, in the 8th district, in the 10th district, I believe, look, there is no reason that if you're a Democrat, you should not feel very good about being able to flip a state like Michigan or flip a state like Wisconsin if the numbers stay where they are right now. but never underestimate the Democratic Party's ability to shoot itself in the foot.
Yeah, and, you know, the polls line up like they did last time. Everybody, the major contenders, are beating Trump by double digits. But Hillary was beating Bernie by 25. Hillary was beating Trump by 15. Do not underestimate the hidden vote.
Yep.
We're going to see a lot of you back home here in the next year, I'm assuming.
Oh, I'll be back there, in a few weeks for the debate. And you and I are going over to Grand Trunk, right?
Yeah, we'll meet you at American Coney Island, too. I think I'm doing some CNN, man.
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. Your play. You're a company man now. I gotta plug your joint.
Well, yeah, I'm not gonna send you the Coney kit. I want to cut down on the carbon footprint. You know, being a little, you know, neoliberal conservative, fiscally, socially, you know, open to whatever. So
I'll be back there plenty, though. I'll be bothering you.
All right, brothers. Listen, man. Congratulations on the book, American Carnage. Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Political Magazine and the No Bullshit News Hour. Excellent work, dude. Congratulations.
Hey, thanks, Carly. Appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye. Great dude, man. Great dude. Thanks, Tim. We'll see
thanks,
you.
Thanks, Tim.
We'll see you at the debate, bro. And, Joe, hope you're happy with your glasses. And, Karen,
get better, girl.
We'll see you next week. And remember, everybody, try to respect one another.
Pretty girl, beware of this heart.